by Elisha, right? So Elijah has gone, so we will miss him. Elisha is going to die today, I think, if we get to that. He's going to die. This much I know for sure. Maybe next week. But yeah, so we left this story off where God has now used this woman who's ministering to Elisha, who's provided him room and board and a place to stay and a place to come study and what have you. And he is pushing on her a little bit, and we're going to see why. So beginning of the story starts with this woman who basically has need of nothing, right? And she's juxtaposed to the story before that, to the woman who needed something, who was financially at wit's end, and God provides for her jars and jars of oil for her to sell. She was in a financial need. The Shunammite woman that we meet in chapter 4, verse 8 and following has no need, okay? And we're going to see that she actually does. She just doesn't want to talk about it, okay? And what was her need? What did we discover? She needs a kid, right? She's got a husband that's about to die, and no son, no heir to the throne. And we've seen in other stories that's obviously a bad thing. Okay, so verse 14, she has no son. Her husband is old, says Gehazi. In verse 15, now Elisha and her are going to have a conversation. Okay, verse 16, this is the promise from Elisha to this woman.
And he said, at this season, about this time next year, you shall embrace a son. And she said, no, my lord, O man of God, do not lie to your servant. But the woman conceived, and she bore a son about that time, the following spring, as Elisha had told.
All right, so this obviously is a big deal for her. And verse 18, we kind of fast forward in this kid's story. He's grown. He went out to his father's with the reapers. And in verse 19, so this kid's old enough to be in the field. He's working, shearing sheep and reaping and what have you. He said to his father, my head, my head. So not sure exactly what's wrong with this kid, but something, some sort of headache or stroke or something going on in the kid's head. Serious enough where they carry him inside to his mother. Verse 20, here's what happens to the kid.
And when he had lifted him and brought him to his mother, the child sat on her lap till noon, and then he died.
Wow. So, I mean, talk about this story. This woman has a need that kind of lay deep under the surface, right? Elisha exposes it, finds out she really wants a child. God provides a child. And then what does God do? He takes the kid away. I mean, how do you feel about that? I mean, if that's you, like married couple, what? How do you feel about that when you're dying to have a kid, you're wrestling with infertility, God finally provides a kid and then kills your kid?
I feel tricked. Yeah.
Bitter, angry, tricked, deceived. I mean, that's heartbreaking, right? This is a great story, by the way, about people that suffer with, not suffer, we all do, but with just disappointment with God, right? Whatever it may be, we have expectations on how God is supposed to work, and he doesn't do things on our timetable. He doesn't do things the way that we would do them if we were in control. You know that woman would say, like, what have I done wrong? Why would you take my kid away? What did I do to deserve this? We've all been in those seasons of life where we feel like God is doing something to us or against us, and we kind of raise our hands in frustration and say, what the heck, you know, what did I do to deserve this? And she's there, right? And she's going to be pretty honest with Elijah in this process. Okay, she went up to him and laid him on the bed. The man of God shut the door behind him and went out. Verse 22, she called to her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and return. Now, how did she feel about Elisha before having a kid? Who was Elisha to her? Some prophet that she took care of, right? Oh, I'm happy to bless him, and here's some eggs Benedict and a place to come stay when you're here. That's great. How do you think she feels about Elisha now?
It's partly his fault.
Partly his fault. Okay. What is she hitting in her life? Does she have need of him now? Oh yeah, right. What is God doing in her? Testing her faith and creating a need, right? So, hey, can you fix this problem with your cash? No, you can't. How about that, right? And again, I see this all too often, and I don't think it's necessarily bad, but God's going to create a need. Whether you think you have one or not, he's going to find a way to show you, listen, you have a rope, and I'm going to get you to the end of it. And at the end of that, I'm going to be there, but I'm going to make you depend on me. And it may be a financial rope, it may be a health rope, it may be situational in life in a gazillion different other areas. But so often with folks that have the financial wherewithal to solve those issues, they often get struck with issues in life that money can't resolve, and vice versa, right? Some of us that don't have money have decent health, right? But we've got other issues, and some have both. And it's you wonder sometimes why God does this, but he is going to get this woman to her breaking point where she realizes, man, Elijah's not some kid that I take care of that does nice things. He is going to be, to me, the means to God, and that's ultimately what I need to solve my problem, okay? So she calls for Elisha and realizes, man, I need this kid now. Gehazi meets her halfway in verse 26. She's on her way to Mount Carmel to go meet Elisha. Gehazi meets her and says, hey, is it well with you? Verse 26, she says, yeah, it's well, meaning get the heck out of my way. I don't want to talk to you. I want to deal with Elisha. So she gets in front of him. And in verse 27, this is how she now approaches Elisha. Read that.
And when she came to the mountain to the man of God, she caught hold of his feet. Gehazi came to push her away, but the man of God said, leave her alone, for she is in bitter distress, and the Lord has hidden it from me and has told me.
So what does her posture tell you about where she's at right now? She's at his feet, begging him, right, to do something. So this is a broken woman. You can see the progression in her life where God hit her in an area that was very, very sensitive, okay? And here's her response. She's going to be pretty honest. 28 and following, keep going.
Then she said, did I ask my Lord for a son? Did I not say, do not deceive me?
What does that mean? I was fine before. Like, I dealt with the pain of not having a kid, and I just kind of wanted to live life not having to go there, okay? And she said, I didn't even ask you for a kid, okay? You dug and you exposed something that you found. You gave me a kid, and then you deceived me. What does that mean? What's the deception that she feels on Elisha's part?
You gave me a son.
Exactly. Like, that's her perception, right? That in her pain, that's how she sees it. And that's honestly, that's a pretty valid response given her situation. Like, why would God do that to me? You give me something just to tear it out of my hand? Like, do you enjoy inflicting pain on me? And that, does that make you happy, God, that you would? Why not just not give me a kid in the first place, right? That's her logic. Like, that's awful. And God is trying to do something more in her, and he's going to. But in the midst of it, she can only see her pain, and she sees God through a very different lens right now than she ultimately will. Okay? 29, keep going.
He said to Gehazi, tie up your garment and take my staff in your hand and go. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not reply. And lay my staff on the face of the child.
Meaning, don't talk to anybody. Go straight back to her son. Here's my staff. Take it with you and keep going to 30.
And the mother of the child said, as the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So he arose and followed her.
What does that mean? Elisha sends Gehazi with his staff to go back to the boy to presumably do what? Raise the kid from the dead, right? So, okay. So he's got a history of being able to do that. So fair enough. What does she say to him, to Elisha? As the Lord lives, I will not leave your side. Elisha sends Gehazi. She says, I'm not leaving without you.
Does she think he might disappear and she'll have like
now? Who does she want to come back home with him? Her. Elisha. She's saying, I don't want Gehazi. Don't give me JV. I want you or I'm not going. So, and not, no. Punking Gehazi per se, though he's gonna eat crow next chapter. But she says, I want you and only you. So do you see the dependence that this woman is now? Elisha's not just some trinket, right? This is now a real deal for her, okay? Gehazi passed before them in verse 31, laid the staff on the lad's face, but there was neither sound nor response. So he returned to meet him and took him and said, the lad is not awakened. What does that mean? What did Gehazi attempt to do? Resurrect him. How'd it go? Not so well. Okay. Why would God make this go down this way? Why would you? Gehazi comes, puts the staff on this kid. You know the end of the story. This kid's gonna be raised from the dead. But Gehazi can't do it with Elisha's staff. So Elisha's gonna have to come and do it. What's the meaning behind that?
Because the power's not in the staff.
Exactly. The power's not in the staff. The power is in the man of God who is sourced with his power ultimately in God. Okay, so you're seeing her distress level rise, right? Gehazi couldn't do it. The lad is not awakened. 32, Elisha came into the house, and behold, the lad was dead and laid on his bed. So in case there's a question, like he's dead, okay? They entered and shut the door behind him, and they both lay and prayed to the Lord. Okay, 34, keep going.
Then he went up and lay on the child, putting his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands. And as he stretched himself upon him, the flesh of the child became...
I mean, literally, he just puts himself on top of the child. I mean, that's the picture of just, like, complete desperation, right, from Elisha. And what happens to the kid in 34?
And the flesh became warm.
What does that mean? He comes back to life, right? I mean, this mother is watching her child that she's always wanted, given, died, and now given back. I mean, you think she has a different perspective of God about right now? I'd say so, right? 35, keep going.
Then he got up again and walked once back and forth in the house, and went up and stretched himself upon him. The child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes.
Why would they mention that the lad sneezed 7 times? Any notes in your Bible on that one, or any guesses? It's an old school Jewish tradition that when Adam was created, he sneezed afterwards. It was a sign of life. So there is, I don't know how much like stock to put into that, but there is a belief that when Adam was created by God, that he sneezed and it was a sign of life. Okay, so that's what the best commentators I've read have said. Okay, so there is life. Okay, so that's the idea. Okay. 36 rather, keep going.
Then he summoned Gehazi and said, call this Shunammite. So he called her, and when she came to him, he said, pick up your son. She came and fell at his feet, bowing to the ground. Then she picked up her son and went out.
Now, what's different about this gal as she leaves? I mean, the text doesn't give you all of it, but what would you guess? What does it mean that she bowed at his feet? It's a sense of worship and gratefulness, right? For sure.
Sorry, that was...
I thought we'd be past that by now, Melanie. Me! Have I personally?
No.
No.
Have you ever like talked about anything, what they felt or what they...
I don't know that we get a ton of that insight. Lazarus is the other one in the New Testament.
Right.
No, I don't think we have any.
I feel like they never say anything.
Probably good reason, right? I had someone made the observation that we don't know a lot about heaven because we'd all want to be there. Like it was described in great detail or too much that we would all. I thought that's interesting. So yeah, I wonder like what would their first hand experience be? Yeah, so dead and come back. Yeah, he had to be disappointed. Like, dang it.
God made sure they didn't say anything or else somebody would have wrote a book and made a movie about it.
Weird, yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So if you look at this gal from where she started at the beginning of chapter 4 with no need of God, self-sufficient, I'm all good, where has God taken her in 37 short verses? I mean, that's a tough journey, right? And we get in 37 verses, but this is the kid that you didn't have his promise. So there's 9 months. Kid's born. He's at some certain age where he can be outside in the field working, which puts him at 10, 11, 12, 13, 18. Who knows? I mean,
she
but...
picks him up.
Yeah, so she can carry him. So, yeah, probably not 15. He's not a sack potato, so good point. Callie with her masterful observations. Dang, can't fool her even at 6 in the morning. So old enough to do some work, so and then taken away from him, from her and her husband for that matter, and then ultimately brought back. I mean, you think this gal's life has been completely changed? It's fascinating what God is willing to do to get to the heart of a person, right? Like, if you don't see the need, I'm going to help you find it. So that always scares me about some of my dearest friends that don't know the Lord. I go, man, I wonder, like, what is God going to do with you to help you see the need that you have for him? And if you can't see it because of your, you know, station in life or just everything's okay and, you know, life's good, and finances are taken care of, it's like, I wonder where he's going to hit you. So Teach up thought.
No, it's cool how she stole, she ran to Elisha and like fell at his feet, in both when she was in distress and in joy.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I'm just picturing, you know, like, you know, today, you know, I think the first time I would have ran to Elisha and be like, what the heck, and try to strangle him.
Angry.
She bows down before, and, you know, like, in this, you know, in desperation, and then at the same time she bows down.
Yeah, it's a good observation.
Is she an Israelite?
Yeah, she is. Shunammite is... I'm trying to remember where she's from. Yeah, but I think so. Isn't... wasn't Solomon's bride? Shunammite as well, yeah? I'm trying to remember where that... But it's Israeli. I just don't know where the... distinction is. So anyway, yes, but I'm fairly sure, but yeah, anyway, so somebody look that up. Anyway, so it's a fascinating story. So I mean, again, this is what I like about Kings. Here's a great story of, at some point in your life, has not everybody gone through this process of being disappointed with God? God didn't meet my expectations. I traveled through a valley full of pain and desperation and loneliness, and on the other side of that, there's God, and he meets my needs. And in the midst of it, I had no idea why. And clearly the why behind this, God is gracious enough to give, which is, I was after your heart the whole time. And if you're not going to see your need, I'm going to create the need. So anyway, great one to tuck away. The beauty of this stuff is no one teaches it. So you can be the first and the best ever to do it. So because nobody knows it. No one teaches it. But there's phenomenal stories in here. Okay. So... all right, now more on Elisha and Gehazi. This is where he. This is a fascinating story, especially for those of you guys going into ministry. Okay, this is a good reminder. Okay, verse 1 of chapter 5. Let's continue there. Oh, my bad. I totally skipped that, didn't we? Yeah, this is the college apartment story. All right. Sorry, I forgot that we missed that. I was so excited to get the name in. All right, so that is now miracle 7 that we've seen. Here comes miracle 8, okay? It's an odd miracle, but nonetheless, here you go, okay? 38, Jessica, since you were so excited about reading this text, keep going.
And Elisha came again to Gilgal when there was a famine in the land. And as the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, he said to his servant, set on a large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets.
All right, so you got all Elijah and now Elisha's prophet school, right? They're making dinner, and he says, put on a pot of stew for us. One went out into the field, got some herbs, and they put something into the pot that was like, I don't know, toxic. So they picked the wrong thing. So they got some wild, crazy mushrooms. I have no idea. And they found out after they, in verse 40, they said, oh, man of God, there is death in the pot, and they were unable to eat. So... I don't know how you guys grew up, but we had a lot of casseroles growing up in our house. I have a friend, they call it five-shelf casserole, because you pick all five shelves in your pantry and you dump whatever that is into a crock pot, and that's what you're eating for the night, right? So five-shelf casserole, I'm like, that's pretty creative. Some turn out great, some were like, mystery. So, yeah, in certain households you knew. You know, on these nights, parents made dinner. On these nights, it was leftover night. So you found a house to sleep over at, you know, as you got older, so that you didn't have to have leftover night or whatever. So anyway, it's stew night in the school of Elisha's house, right? And they make some goulash, whatever, that turns out to be dead. And they literally can't eat it because it's awful. So verse 41 here is Elisha's response.
He said, then bring flour. And threw it into the pot and said, pour some out for the men, and they may eat. And there was no harm in the pot.
So Elijah makes the food okay to eat. So I don't know the significance of that, but he makes it work. So he puts, yours says flour, mine says meal. So whatever he puts in it, or he does something. So obviously he's, after just, you know, raising a guy from the dead just to fix dinner, that doesn't seem so significant to me, but whatever, it's there, okay? Anyway.
What was the sixth miracle? Was it that she had a son?
Yes, that she had a son. Yep. Chapter 4, verse 16, that he promises to bring life. Yeah, I would say that he foresees that.
And the seventh is to the raising of the dead.
Yep. And the eight is he can make a crock pot meal. So.
So
Don't go on a date with Elisha, because that's what you're eating for dinner. So, no bueno. Yeah. All right. So there's miracle eight. Okay, give it to the people that may eat. There's certainly maybe a picture of Jesus feeding the 5,000, right? I don't know. There's some spiritual stuff here that they give now to the people and they eat in verse 42. Anyway.
Miracles with flour.
Yeah, there you go. Who doesn't want to do miracles with flour? I'd rather have a chapter 4 miracle and raise people from the dead if we got to choose. However, cool nonetheless. All right. Now chapter 5. Let's get to Naaman. 5:1. All right, so tell me about Naaman. Who is this guy? Where's he from?
Syria,
right? So this is the Joab of Syria, okay? So this guy's a warrior. He's from a pagan country that is an enemy of Israel. But we're going to find out he's got a need, and he's going to hear about the God of Israel through some random servant from Israel that Ben-Hadad had picked up along the way through battle, okay? So he's a leper is the issue, right? So leprosy is, in their day and age, uncurable, okay? The Arameans, verse 2, had gone out in bands and attacked and taken captive a little girl from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. So this gal is a servant in the household of Naaman and is very... apparently well respected. Okay, so she's gotten favor with this royal family.
Would he not be like an outcast if he had leprosy?
For sure. Less so in that society, more so in Israel because of his issue. So
yeah, he's got like a job and stuff. So
apparently, I guess he was such a great warrior that and leprosy can be slow moving too. So it just depends on how it affects you.
Are you born with it?
It's a disease that you can get, so no, you can acquire it later in life. Exactly. Yes, it is very contagious. So Hansen's disease, I think, is the modern day, but it's all been eradicated. But yeah, that was part of the reason they would quarantine people. But it starts in the extremities. Like, you'll get it in the tips of your ears, your fingertips, your toes, and it will spread through your body. We're going to see a king, I don't think this morning, maybe this morning, who gets it. And it's a really fascinating disease. We'll get into it with Uzziah in a bit.
Quick question. In verse 42, before, is that a ninth miracle or is that still part of the eighth where he multiplies the first fruit?
I just keep it with the eighth. Or keep it with, yeah, all of that is the food miracle. Yeah, I count it as eight. Yep. So does Ryrie in my... handy dandy study Bible chart. So, Chuck, don't lie. Charles Ryrie, for reference. Yeah, so I would say it's all the same. Yep. All right, so we got Naaman. He is a leper from Syria. He's the Joab of the armies there, okay? We find out that there's a servant girl inside of his home that is from Israel, okay? Verse 3, this is her request. Read that. So, I mean, that's a pretty, you get an idea of what this relationship was like when she's like, man, I really wish you met Elijah because I would love for you to be cured. So this is a healthy relationship. Naaman went and told his master saying, thus and thus spoke the girl who was from the land of Israel. So he hears for the first time in his life, there's a guy out there that can cure your leprosy, right? And that's obviously a pretty big deal. He goes to the king of Aram or Syria and he says, great, here's a letter. Go see this guy. And they don't know who this guy is yet. Okay. He departed in verse 5, took with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 changes of clothes. Now, you don't necessarily know what talents and shekels and all that either any more than I do, but what would you guess if you were the Joab of the Syrian king? Would you guess that's a little bit of money? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, here's a new wardrobe, here's a ton of cash, right? You're going with the idea of not bribing, but saying thank you, like this guy can heal you, and if he does, then give him some thank you in return, okay? Verse 6, watch where he delivers this letter.
And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, when this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you the name of my servant, but you may cure him of his leprosy.
Who's the king of Israel right now, by the way? I know it's confusing. Jehoram or Joram, okay? So he's the guy that we're, he's, remember that guy just because he's going to get a ton of texts because Elisha ministers during his day. He's not any better, I guess, suppose not any worse than any of the others, but because of Elisha, he's the guy on the block, okay? So this letter gets to him saying, hey, cure my guy of leprosy. And he's like, what? So this is his answer, verse 7.
When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Only consider and see how he is taking a quarrel with me.
Now, he's got some great theology in there. He says, am I God? You're like, good. You know, ego-inflated king, you realize that you're actually not God. Am I able to kill and to make a lot? Like, I can't do this, right? So he's very honest about the fact that, like, I don't have those abilities. What does he think's going on end of verse 7?
It's a trick.
Heal my guy, or we're coming to battle against you. He's like, man. So he feels a little bit stuck. Now, verse 8, keep going. Now, this, you know, Joram should have known better that, yeah, maybe Elisha can. Hello, he's a prophet. He's got a history of raising people from the dead. Like, that would have gone out. So he doesn't think about it. So it tells you where he's at spiritually. Naaman came in verse 9 with his horses and his chariots and stood at the doorway of the house of Elisha. Elisha sent a messenger to him saying, go and wash yourself in the Jordan 7 times and your flesh shall be restored to you and you shall be clean. Now, Elisha, number one, what do you notice in verse 10? What's describe to me the situation of what happens to Naaman here. What is he told to do? Go wash. Okay, where? Jordan. Okay, not to disappoint you guys, the Jordan River is incredibly unimpressive. Okay, at least today, the stream doesn't flow like it used to. It's not this gorgeous, picturesque river. There's parts of it that are really cool. There's parts of it that are not. Okay, who tells Naaman to do that? By the way,
a messenger.
So Gehazi, right? Elisha doesn't even come. So he just tells him, go wash in the Jordan. So that's like saying, you know, you come to see Brad, you know, and you get somebody else that says, go wash in the canal bank. And you're like, that's kind of filthy. Like, is there not somewhere better that I could go wash? Like, and he's going to say, back home? Like, I got way nicer rivers. Do you want me to go wash where? So he's kind of like, wait a second. Now, but what's Elijah say? What if you do this, then what? You're going to be clean. Like, you're going to be healed of your leprosy. You think he would say, okay, I'm at least willing to give it a try, right? Why not? What's it going to hurt? I'm going to go jump in a river and, you know, worst case scenario, I'm just wet and maybe not healed and still have leprosy. But that's not his response. Verse 11, read that.
But Naaman was angry and went away saying, behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call upon the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the place.
Isn't that a great text? I thought God would act like this. It would be like coming out of Egypt. It would be the sweet magic show. This guy with the wand would be like, wah! You know, it'd be like really cool. And he would zap me and I would be healed. Like, right? It's the same story again. It's the woman who comes to Elisha and says, I thought God would behave in this way. In my little world, in the little box that he fits in, this is how God is supposed to work, okay? And that's his expectation with Elisha and with Elisha's God. I thought this would go down like this, and when it doesn't, I'm out. I don't want to do it, right? It's fascinating that they both have the same core issue of, I have expectations of God, of how he is to behave on my behalf. And when he doesn't do that, I've got the freedom to kind of whine and cry or whatever, okay? And here's his answer, verse 12. I mean, it's a very, he's right, in a sense.
Are not our bonnet and far.
Sure. far. Yeah.
Is better than all the waters of Israel? If I not wash in them and be clean? So he turned and went away in a rage.
I mean, you get a great, he's like, man, that's a filthy river. Like, I'm not going to wash in that. And he leaves angry. You're like, wow, like, you came all this way with money and this long journey to this pagan king, to this pagan prophet who worships a different God, and you get a, here's how it can go down, and you won't even go through the process? I mean, that's fascinating to me. That's the gospel, right? Submit yourself to Christ. Be honest about your own sin and shortcomings. Call yourself a sinner. Put your place in the need of God, and you can be saved. It's that simple. Well, no, I don't need God. I'm not a sinner. I'm not, what? Like, I'm not, I don't need that crutch. You're like, wow, like, that's the offering that a God would lay his life down for you, and you can't humble yourself enough just to admit your own sin and shortcomings? That's your hang up? Yeah. I'm going to go away mad. I mean, there's a great picture of how people respond to the gospel in here and God, and when they just don't want to get downwind of themselves to realize I'm not in control and this is how God has it. And I don't dictate to God the terms. He tells me how to do it. So he leaves angry. Okay. Now verse 13, let's keep going. Like, think about it, Naaman. This guy said, wash and you're going to be clean. Is this not a great thing? Regardless of the mode, like, this was his, like, this is a great thing. So his own servants have to talk some sense into him. Okay, keep going.
So he went down and dipped himself seven times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child.
Wow. You know, now he has to do it seven times, which had to make him even more angry. But you get the idea that he's willing now. Like, he comes to his senses in verse 13, and the servants say, man, why don't you at least give it a try? And he does. And what happens? Miracle 9. The guy, he's cured from his leprosy. Yeah, Pete.
You ever ask Roman, like, what dipping in the water, like, seven, what's considered, like, one dip? Like, just going down underwater?
I would assume it's probably in and out seven times, I would guess. Yeah, so it'd have been... it'd have been tedious.
Get in the water, walk all the way out.
In, out. Yeah, it's probably not just dunk my head and, you know, no, it's probably pretty significant in terms of just, you know, and why seven? Complete, right? I mean, there's some significance behind that. Good, you guys are finally thinking Hebrew. I like it. Not finally. You are thinking Hebrew, right? It's the idea of he's going to be completely healed by God on God's terms. And if you don't like it, you know, there's the road straight back to Damascus. So, bye. That's how God works, okay? So, he washes seven times. Now, 15 and following. Watch the end result of the story. This is the part that's great for ministry, I think.
And then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Please accept now a gift from your servant.
So 15, what does he say, Mark?
We're saying that there's Israel, you know, God lives in Israel.
What do you call that? There's no... he just became a Christian, right? He's like, holy cow, your God is legit, right? I am a follower of your God. And we're going to find out it's for real. Like, he's healed and he is fully... this guy, this is a conversion, and it's the real deal conversion. He's not some, you know, mouth professor, and he's going to go back and do his own thing. He wants to follow the God of Israel, okay? And what else does he say?
He wants to give him something.
Yeah, so, hey, can I say thanks, right? Is there anything wrong, by the way, with that? No. Is there anything wrong with accepting a gift in return for... not necessarily, right? Now, for whatever reason, this is in 16, this is Elisha's response.
The prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept the thing. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused.
So where does Elisha stand on this? What does he say? No, I don't want anything. Naaman urges him, and Elisha says, absolutely not. Why would you guess that Elisha says no? I don't want anything from you. It's free. He probably wants to make sure that he understands it's from God, that there's no, like, you're not paying for this. Like, we don't give this to the elites, and the non-elites can't get it because they can't pay for it. For whatever reason, I think Elisha just felt the conviction of this is not appropriate. This is a foreigner. We've introduced him to our God. We don't want there to be confusion about this is from my hand. Like, ultimately, no, this is from God. And I really don't think that there would have been anything intrinsically wrong with him saying, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. So let's go, you know, let's let's go to the store and buy groceries, and thank you very much, okay? But he says, no, absolutely not. And for whatever reason, that was his conviction. And he says, no, okay? So this is what's really cool about Gehazi, okay? Keep reading in 18. Not Gehazi, Naaman, sorry, gosh.
Or
18
or 17?
Yeah, you know what, 17 would be even better, because that's the cool part.
If you will not send in, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other gods but the Lord.
Now, we have never seen this before. Naaman requests what?
Dirt.
Dirt. Why dirt?
Because it's God's land.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's God's land's dirt. Something like that. It's all those words in probably a different order. It's the dirt from God's land. And he said, I want to take 2 wheelbarrows full home. Why? Like, this maybe isn't the right theology, but God's like, I like where this guy's going. Like, you're going to take my dirt back to Syria, and we're going to see. He's going to tell you what he's going to do. So it's fascinating to me the way that Naaman thinks, okay? So he says, 18, yes, thank you. 17's right out. 18's right there. Keep going.
So may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he's leaning on my arm, and I bow there also. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant.
So my master, Ben-Hadad, worships this pagan god, and I have to go worship with him. So he's not quite there to say, I'm just not going to go, because he likes his job, I guess, and realizes that's not an option. So what is he going to do with the dirt? Yeah, he's going to say, I'm going to worship your god, now my god, in this other guy's house. And I'm just praying that God will know my heart and forgive kind of the actions behind that. And it's like, huh. And you know, Elisha says, like, you know what? Yeah, go in peace. That's I like your heart in that. Okay, so it's a fascinating picture of him saying, I want dirt from the land to be able to worship on. Right. So maybe as you guys come back from Israel, get some rocks and then get some dirt as well. So it's a great response, and I just love his heart in that. Right. And you look at it and go, probably not theologically correct, but Elisha's like, that's all right. That, don't worry about it. You're all good. Okay. Now, the problem is, 19, Elisha says, go in peace. Like, get your dirt. Get out of here. Good hanging out with you. Best of luck to you. All right. Verse 20. Here's the rest of the story.
Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, my master was too easy on Naaman. This Aramean, by not accepting from him what he brought, as surely as the Lord lives, I'll run after him and get something from him.
Okay. So, what's. Tell me about Gehazi.
He wants to get paid
for what they did, okay? And, you know, labor is worthy of his wage. There's something behind that. You're like, okay, there's a time and a place for that, right? Problem is, Elisha said no, and he said, no, we're going to shut it down. We're not doing that. Tell me about, how would you guess that Elisha and Gehazi live, given the story that we just read in chapter 4, end of verse 4? Yeah, they're probably paycheck to paycheck. You know, they're eating stew with a bunch of guys in a college apartment. Like, they're not hanging out at Ruth Chris and dropping $200 on dinner. Like, that's not their lifestyle. So when a guy comes that's loaded, who's got a genuine heart, and you heal him, and he just says, man, can I just say thank you? And Elisha says no. He's thinking, dude, you're an idiot. Like, why not? You know, we're hungry. I could use another pair of Levi's. Like, hello. Like, this would be nice. So Gehazi's like, my master's an idiot. I need to go back and make sure that we get something. Okay. So verse 21, keep going.
So Gehazi hurried after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running toward him, he got down from the chariot to meet him. Is everything all right? He asked. Everything was all right, Gehazi answered. My master sent me to say, 2 young men from the company of the prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 sets of clothing.
What do you call that? No. That's a dirty lie, okay? So, yeah, no, that's not actually what happened, okay? So Naaman says, great, be pleased. Here's 2 talents. Here's some changes of clothes. Like, great, whatever you need. Don't know why he changed his mind, but that's what I came for to begin with. So he gives him the stuff. They exchanged their goodbyes, 24. He came to the hill. He took from their hand, and he deposited them in the house, and he sent them away, and they departed. 25. But when he went in and stood before his master, so Gehazi is now standing before Elisha. Elisha says to him, "Where have you been, Gehazi?" And he said, "Your servant went nowhere," which is another lie. Okay, 26, keep going.
But Elisha said to him, "Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? Is this the time to take money or accept clothes, olive groves, vineyards, flocks, herds, or men servants or maid servants?"
What does that mean? Is this the time to receive money, clothes, olives, goats, sheep, you know, a partridge in a pear tree? What is he saying? I know where you've been. I know exactly what you did. I know what you got in your pocket, right? What else?
There's a right time
and a wrong time. And for whatever reason, Elisha felt like it's not appropriate. It somehow is going to diminish this guy's view of God or of us, and it's just not the right time, right? So, no, we're not going to do it. So, and again, I don't know exactly why. Clearly, it's, you know, Paul talks about this in the New Testament. He asks for money. He asks churches to support the work that he's doing. There's a right and a wrong time. And for Elisha, this was the wrong time.
Could it be that?
Could it
be? I mean, there's stuff that, you know, miracles happening left and right. So he could be getting, you know, people probably offering him a ton of stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe, could it be that Elisha has that heart, like, no, if I were to take something from everything that's happening, I'll be rich right now. You know, and then people would see, oh, he only does that for the material stuff, and it diminishes the people who God is.
Yeah. Run with that for a second. So, I'll get to you in a second. We had a seminary professor in class that said, man, you hear this this misnomer that there's no money to be made in ministry. He's like, you can go make a killing in ministry and make a grip of cash. Just turn on the TV, right? What do you see? You know, you see guys preaching health, wealth, and prosperity, and if God is really with you, then you're healthy and you're loaded, right? And they are. They're healthy and loaded. And if you've got the right message and the right whatever, there's money to be made, right? There really is. He said, so don't buy into that deal that there's not money to be made. If you want to go down that road, you certainly can. I think that's what Elijah was getting at, and that wasn't his motive. What was Gehazi's motive? He wants to go down that road. He wants to be compensated for what he does at a certain level. And again, that's not evil, but somewhere in there was a line that Elijah said, I don't feel good about that, you know. And I don't know that it was a black and white line so much. It was I don't feel comfortable with that. So you talk about moral discernment. Elijah says, I think we probably could, but I think we're going to say no. And God says, no, I think we're going to say yes. And now he's in sin because he's not submitting to his master. So, and we talked about it from the stance of like, random. I remember when we were taught this when I was sitting in your seats, our pastor said, what if Budweiser offered us $1 million to sponsor our church? And they just wanted to put a big logo in the sanctuary. But it came with $1 million check. Is it wrong to drink? No. So would it be wrong to take money from a company that you're like, yeah, it just feels dirty. Like, no, I think we'd say no, right? You know, if McDonald's wanted to sponsor Off the Front, who's trying to deal with childhood obesity, would we say, how many zeros are on that check? You know, for $1,000, no. But for $100,000, like, I'd probably think twice and check my, you know, I don't know. So, but you wrestle with those moral tensions of like, and that's what it was. This guy had a ton of cash, and he could write their ticket. And Elisha just says, I don't feel good about that. I don't want to be enslaved to that guy, to somehow think he owns me and owns my God. No, like something about it just felt stinky to him. So he said no, okay? Anyway, so I like where he's going with it. And that had to be hard to turn down, knowing I'm going to go back to, you know, beans and rice at home with my college frat buddies and hope that they didn't screw up the stew again, right? I don't know. So, Anicelli, what were you thinking?
Is it because he worshipped gods, and then, like, for them, they, in order to receive something, they had to give the gods? So they're putting God on a higher.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too. I think he's trying to differentiate their god with the gods that Naaman is used to worshiping. It's unbelievable. So, yeah, it just gets stupid in May and April, too. So yeah, I think that's a part of it as well. So he's trying to make some sort of distinguishment that you can't buy my God, his powers, his, like, he offers them for free. And what it takes is a humble, submitted heart. And Gehazi got there, or Naaman got there. So for what it's worth. Yeah, so I think it's a good observation. So anyway, it's a great story. So and it's a great story to communicate to folks that specifically, I think, in ministry, it's a temptation for all of us when none of us get into ministry to go make a killing, but you can, and you want to feed your family, and that's, there's nothing wrong with that, right? But there's a line somewhere where as you move onward, there are always, especially with churches that get older, right? When we were young at the Well, you know, just we were, Brad calls it college poor, right? Like, there was nobody that would try to write checks to influence decisions. You'll see that later on. Hey, I'm going to write a check for 50 grand to the Well, and I'd like to see this guy hired in youth ministry. Or I'd like to see this money go here. I want to see, you're like, it gets really tempting. And you say, you know what? No, we're not going to accept that. And there's, you'll find folks like that in ministry that want to bless you, but there is a motive behind that, and there's strings attached, and you got to be really careful with that. Okay, so for what it's worth, okay. So there's miracle 10. Okay, he is miracle 9. I guess would be that he. Where was miracle 9? Miracle 9 is that he heals Gehazi, and then 10 is in verse 27. We haven't read yet. Okay, read that. Watch what happens now to Gehazi. 27, last verse of chapter 5.
Therefore the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went out from his presence a leper like snow.
Ooh, like that's... Yeah, that's rough. That's a bad day, right? So he gets leprosy, okay? So, yeah, that's it's a rough day, okay? So... Yeah, but you got to change the clothes with it, though, so now you're at least you're a well-dressed leper, and good for you. So, yeah. All right, chapter 6, okay? Here comes miracle 11.
Oh, is that just miracles?
Yeah. Yes, 10, yeah. Not that you need to know all those, but if you want to make them for reference, okay? I'm not going to ask you the eighth miracle of Elisha on the test, okay? Dang it, I missed one! No.
Just real quick, going back. Shunem is a small village mentioned in the Bible. It's located in the tribe of Issachar in the north of Jezreel and south of Mount Gilboa.
Okay. Gilboa is where Saul dies. Jezreel Valley, so it's all in that same area. Okay.
What land is that?
Issachar. Yeah? Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. One of the tribes. Maybe helpful to know. You may want to know, say, 3 or 4 of them, okay?
Well, including the two sons?
I would know the Transjordan tribes if I were you, so yes. Good. All right. Another miracle. Again, not quite as cool as this one, but it's cool nonetheless. I can't do this. 6:1.
So the sons of the prophets said to Elijah, "See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, and each of us get there a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there." He answered, "Go."
All right, so the idea is this prophet group is growing. They're doing great ministry, and they've outgrown their house, okay? So they're going to make a new house. And he says, great, okay? So they go build this house. In verse 5, one was felling a tree beam, and the axe head fell into the water, and he cried out, "Alas, my master, for it was borrowed," right? You know that's a bad day when you're college poor, right, and you borrow something from somebody because you can't afford it, and then you break it, and you're like, oh, no, like... It was already a bad axe head, and it had been struck like 10,000 times, and you were 10,001, and it snapped, and you're like, dang it, but now I'm responsible for it. Like, that is such a horrible feel. Like that's why I borrowed it in the first place, because I can't afford to buy it. Now I have to buy it and then return it to the guy and say, here's your new axe. So not only do I not have an axe, now I don't have an axe and money. So these guys are in a panic, okay? So this is Elijah's solution, which, again, it's just funny that it's in here. Verse 6. So the axe head now floats to the surface. Okay, he said, take it up for yourselves, verse 7. He put his hand out and took it. So axe is back. Congratulations. So he can make iron float or whatever it was made out of. I assume it's iron because it says iron. So there you go. Okay. I know. I get a degree from seminary to do that. So you're welcome. Yeah. So cool miracle, I guess. So, you know, there you go. So I've seen, I guess, better ones. But again, I can't do that one either. Neither can you. So we're going to call it a miracle. Okay. So there's 11. Okay. Now, verse 8. Keep going. Back to Ben-Hadad and Israel. All right, so King of Aram is talking about like all these inside training secrets about where they're going to hide and where they're going to be camping to go defeat the armies of Israel, okay? The man of God sent word to the king saying, beware that you do not pass this place, the Arameans are coming down there. So this information gets back to Israel, and Elisha would say, hey, by the way, here's what Ben-Hadad's about to do, so you may want to think about not doing this or not hiding here or not whatever, okay? The heart of the king in verse 11, Ben-Hadad was enraged over this thing, and he calls his servants and says, will you tell me which of us is for the king of Israel? Like, there must be a spy in here. We got a mole that's delivering my messages back to Israel, okay? And one of his servants said, listen, it's not us, it's Elisha, the prophet. He knows everything. He tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom. Like, this guy's got listening devices everywhere. I mean, that's the idea, right? He knows everything you say. And that's got to be a little haunting, okay? So how do you think the king of Aram feels about Elisha about right now? Like, off with his head, right? And that's what he's going to want, okay? Verse 13, keep going.
And he said, go and see where he is, that I may send him and seize him. It was told to him, behold, he is in Dothan, and
okay, we've seen that town long ago. It's in Genesis 37 where the... they went and sheared sheep, right? This is where Levi and Shechem in that story, that takes place in Dothan, and then they went on into Shechem, okay? So they're in the Shephelah, okay, for, not that it matters, but that's where they're at. Okay, keep going. Jeez.
So it would be like, you know, Syria people can just walk into Israel and, like, steal people, and there's, like, nothing. People don't...
In this story, they're commanding to go get Elisha, so yeah, they're basically saying, we're bringing our army in to come get him, because we're going to get... Somehow we need to capture this guy. So
no true borders.
Yeah, there's no fences, there's no whatever. It's just, you know, the strongest man wins. So you want to go to battle and lose some people potentially, and you're going to take that risk, then yeah. So, or it's a Jonathan and his armor bearer type of deal. Like, hey, let's go sneak attack and let's go get Elisha and, you know, Navy SEAL him in the middle of the night and pull him out of bed, and I don't know. So, but they were going to get him. It was that serious. All right, keep going.
So he sent their horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God rose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, alas, my master, what shall we do?
So if you're going to pick a miracle, like, this one's way better. Like, if I got one of the 14, this would be up there in my top five, okay? So Elisha realizes, his servant wakes him up, we're surrounded, we're screwed. The king and his army are here. It's the middle of the night. And Elisha's like, don't worry about it. Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Like, wait a second, dude. Like, there ain't nobody here. It's you and me, and we're sleeping, and our college roommate buddy's eating stew. Like, that's all we got right now.
Do you think it's still Gehazi?
Mm-hmm. I think Gehazi is still with him. Yeah, and I don't know if he was healed or not. He obviously has it for the rest of his life, but I think he stays with him, I think, for the time being. So, good question. But yeah, I think he's there. So, I'd have to look and see if his name is mentioned specifically again. I can't remember offhand. So, but for whatever reason, he gets word from somebody that it is not well, okay? And this is fascinating. Verse 17, read this.
And Elisha prayed and said, O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see. So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha.
Horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. Who were the last people that came in riding on horses and chariots of fire? Yeah, the guy's picking up Elijah on the road trip back to heaven, right? So these would be angels. Okay, so you're like, wow, that's pretty cool. So they're all around. Nobody can see them. Elisha says, just have everybody, like, God give him all spiritual lenses for just a second, and let's see what this battle really looks like. And here are the armies of God. You're like, oh, son. So, yeah, that's miracle 12 right there. Okay. Yep, allowing them to see the angels. Okay. Miracle 13 is coming. Okay. There's only two more left. Okay. Verse 18, when they came down to him, Elisha prayed that the Lord prayed to the Lord and said, hi. Could text him early in the morning. How dare you? So he struck them with, where were we? Elisha said and prayed to the Lord, strike this people with blindness, I pray. So he struck them with blindness according to the word. So he takes the entire Aramean army and they all go blind. Okay. So he doesn't ask for them to be attacked. He blinds all of them. And now this is even funnier, okay? That's 13, okay? So 12 is they get to see the angels. And then 13, they all go blind, okay? This is the king. This is everybody, okay? This is a funny, funny story, okay? Verse 19, keep going.
Elijah said to them, this is not the way and this is not the city. Follow me and I will bring you to the man whom you seek.
So he tells them, no, you guys are all in the wrong spot and you're blind. Let me lead you to actually where you're wanting to go to attack Elisha. I'm Elisha, right? He takes him to where? So, who lives in Samaria? The king of Israel, right? And they're all blind. So here comes blind army marching in. Are you sure it's this way? Yeah, just keep coming. Follow my voice. Like, really? This is funny. So in verse 20, keep going. Now, you had to think that had to be a pretty interesting deal. When they walk into Samaria, they're like, oh, man, we got duped, right? Keep going.
So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria.
And behold, that's probably not what they said. It was probably different wording that they used in the Hebrew, okay? Oh, doo-doo. 21.
As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, my father, shall I strike him down?
Like, let me kill him now, right? And this is a great, I like this. They've won the battle, right? God's blinded them. He's clearly won. These are basically POWs at this point. So he marches them into town, and Joram, the king of Israel, is like, holy cow. Like, you talk about on a silver platter, that's a silver platter. Can I kill them all right now?
So wait, Elisha's saying that he's not who they want?
They came to get Elisha.
Yeah.
So they're all blinded, and then Elisha leads them up to Samaria. They don't know that it's Elisha. And then he walks them right into the enemy's camp, Israel. And now Joram's standing there thinking, great, Elisha, can I kill them all? And he says, no, watch what they do. This is fascinating.
I don't understand. If you're blind, why wouldn't you be like, okay, we're dead, let's go home?
I think because you realize, I can't get home. Like, everybody's blind. So... what other choice do I have, right? We're talking about a hundreds of mile journey, right? I can't walk to my car from here blind, right? So this is a funny story. Speaking of blind guys, one of the guys I went to seminary with was blind, super cool guy. And he was like, he struggled with a little bit of pride, okay? So great guy. And he decided one day he was going to walk from his house to like the other side of the University of North Texas campus, okay? North Texas has 27,000 people, so it's a pretty decent-sized campus. So he literally just is like, I'll figure it out. And this was just Brian, right? And he's a pastor now. He's a great dude. But he walks like across busy streets, and I mean, he doesn't have a dog. He doesn't have one of the, you know, I don't know. He has nothing. He's just like, I'll figure it out. And he can see like, I don't know, maybe 3%. So like, he can see light and maybe motions and like big blurbs, right? And if you he literally reads like this with this huge magnifier, and the letters are like this big, so he can when they're big enough he can see it, but he's legally blind in every way. He walked clear across campus and sure enough shows up at like this event that we had, and like, hey Bellflower, how'd you get here? It's like, I walked, like, pardon? Like, yeah, walked from the house. Like, what, dude? So anyway, so I think they had a little bit further to go and couldn't quite find the way home. So they were trusting in this guy who said they would lead them, okay? And then they show up and realize that was a really dumb decision, okay? And then this is Elisha's answer in verse 22 after Joram, king of Israel, says, can I kill all these guys? Which in his world would have been a great idea. 22.
He answered, you shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow?
What does that mean? Would you strike down those that you've already taken captive with your sword and your bow? These are like women and children that you get after you've won the battle. Would you kill them? No, they're prisoners of war, right? You treat them humanely. You treat them gently. These are prisoners of war. God already won the battle, okay? Set bread and water before them that they may eat and drink and go to their master. Like, not only are you not going to kill them, you're going to go make them dinner. And then you're going to feed them all. And then when you're done feeding them, you're going to let them go home. Like, that's not what he wanted to hear, okay? 23, keep going.
So he prepared for them a great feast, and when they had eaten and drunk, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel.
Mine says, the marauding bands of Arameans did not come into the land of the... Like, mission accomplished? Yeah! Like, did you have to slay them all? No. You killed them with kindness and sent them home. Said, yeah, we could kill y'all, but here's a filet, and a potato, and some asparagus, and enjoy, and then go home. And just leave us alone. And it worked, okay? So... Fascinating that Ben-Hadad's like, all right.
The king of Israel listens to Elisha, but he's evil.
Sometimes he listens to Elisha. Okay. Yes, he is evil. So, yep. Yep. Okay. It's a weird balance. So, I guess when Elisha shows up and men are blindfolded and there's chariots of fire, you're like, this would be a good time to listen. So, I don't know. So, all right. All right. Now, really, story. Okay, this will tell you, like... You guys remember the days of the judges? This is, we're still kind of, we haven't covered like some of the horrendous stuff that's going on. This is horrendous, okay? 24, pick up there.
Afterwards, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, mustered his entire army and went up and besieged Samaria.
Okay, so they come back. So thanks for staying away, but you didn't so much, okay? Yeah, they besieged. It's true. The marauding bands of Arameans did not come. The besiegers came, okay? So whoever they are. 25, keep going. I'm not sure on the amounts, but if you're buying to eat dove's dung, like, okay, you realize there's a famine when you're eating poop and having to pay for it, okay? So it's a bad deal. There's a famine in the land. So keep that in mind for the story that's coming as well. And now the king of Israel was passing by, verse 26, on the wall. A woman cried out to him and said, help. 27, this guy's got great theology. This is Joram. If the Lord does not help you, from where shall I help you? Like, what do you want me to do? Like, there's a famine. It's awful. Do you want me to fix this? Only God can fix this. So he's a pagan king, but he's got great theology. So from the threshing floor, from the wine press, meaning there's no wine, there's no wheat, there's nothing. Like, what do you want me to do, woman? Right? I can't fix the situation. So it's a beautiful picture. And here's how, well, that's a beautiful theology. 27 is an awful picture, or 28 rather. Read that.
And the king asked her, what is your trouble? She answered, this woman said to me, give me your son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow.
Like, okay.
So boiled my son and ate him. Now the next day I said to her, give your son so that we may eat him. But she has hidden her son.
Like, there's so many things wrong with this picture. And even the king of Israel is disgusted by, this is how bad it is. Like, you're eating your children because of the severity of the famine. Like, wow. And they're not even concerned about that. This woman's concerned that this woman won't let her eat her son today. You're like, wow. Like, you're missing the point here, right? And this is, he has a good reaction. I mean, you see that he's thick-headed, but verse 30, he's like, wow. Read that.
When the king heard the words of the woman, he tore his clothes. Now he's passing by on the wall. And people look, and behold, he had sackcloth beneath on his body.
What is he doing? Sackcloth beneath his body. He's mourning. He's mourning the, like, this is horrid. This is my land. People are eating their children. Like, that's unheard. We've never seen this in Israel. That's awful. We've seen Chemosh and people offered to false gods, but boy, not like this. This is just bad. Okay? 31, keep going.
And he said, may God do so to me and more also if the head of Elisha, the son of Shaphat, remains on his shoulders today.
And whose fault is this, by the way? Elisha's, the man of God. Okay. By the way, this is, I think, an interesting observation. Where does he have sackcloth, King Joram? Beneath his what? Beneath his robes. Why would he not be? Yeah. He's mourning in private. Why does he not want to mourn publicly?
He doesn't want people to know what happened.
Potentially. What would that be a sign of for him?
Weakness.
Weakness, right? I'm not going to show that to everybody. I'll mourn privately underneath my clothes. I'll put my robes on top of them. It's an awful situation. So he recognizes that, but he won't break. He won't confess. He won't repent to God to say, I'm done. I can't do anything. This land's in disarray. I am an evil king. I'm going to quit worshiping Baal or whatever. He won't go there. Now he'll try whatever magic trick, and I'll put on the sackcloth, and I'll make this Elisha's fault. Well, Elisha's the godly guy in the land. Buddy, it's your fault. You're the ungodly leader, right? You're the one that has the ability to repent and change the land. He won't do it. So he says, I'm going to just kill Elisha, okay? 32, keep going.
Elisha was sitting in his house, and the elders were sitting with him. Now the king had dispatched a man from his presence. Before the messenger arrived, Elisha said to the elders, do you see how this murderer has sent to take off my head? Look, when the messenger comes, shut the door and bolt the door fast against him. Is not the sound of his master's feet behind him?
So he calls him a murderer, right? So Elisha says, I know who's coming. Like, he's a murderer. He's, you know, this is Ahab's kid. So yeah, I know who he is. He's a son of a murderer. Okay, keep going to 33.
And while he was still speaking with them, the messenger came down to him and said, this trouble is from the Lord. Why should I wait for the Lord any longer?
Okay, so Elisha's trying to get out of this, and he's communicating very clearly that he thinks that this guy's the issue, and 7-1, keep going. The story continues.
But Elisha said, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, tomorrow about this time, a seah of fine flour shall be sold for a shekel, and two
I have no idea. You're doing great, though.
Seahs of barley for a shekel.
Mine says measures. That's why I read in ASB. Smaller
the
words.
Of Samaria. Then the captain.
What does that mean, by the way? Today there's a famine. Tomorrow there's going to be ridiculous abundance. So he's like, you want the famine to be over? I'll fix the famine. Okay, so king of Israel, since this is my fault, tomorrow you're going to see this famine end. Now, how quickly can a famine end? If you have no grapes, no wheat, I mean, he's already said to these women, you want me to go to the wine presses and get wine for you? You want me to go to the, there's nothing. Like, you need years and years to get out of a famine. You got to grow it. You need what, right? He says, tomorrow, there's going to be such abundance it's going to blow your minds. How is that possible, right? And that's the exact question we ask. That's what he asked as well, okay? Keep going in verse 2.
In the captain whose hand the king leaned said to the man of God, if the Lord himself should make windows in heaven, could this thing be?
What does that mean? Yeah, if God dropped food out of the sky, could that happen? Maybe. The idea is like, and he says, behold, your own eyes shall see it. Behold, you shall see it with your own eyes, but you shall not eat of it. What does that mean? You're going to die. You're going to watch God provide, and then you're going to die because of your disbelief. Okay, that's his deal. Okay, so he won't repent. Joram won't repent, but he'll certainly blame Elisha for everything else. Okay, now Brad told the story. I forget why he told it. It was just recently up in the pulpit about the four leprous men. Okay, this is that story. This is the context of the story who roll upon this great abundance. So verse 3, read that.
Now there were four men who were lepers at the entrance of the gate, and they said to one another, why are we sitting here until we die?
So they're leprous men, which means what?
They're outcasts.
So they're in a famine and they're outcasts. They're like, look, we're going to die one way or the other. We're going to die of famine or we're going to die of leprosy. So, man, let's roll the dice. What does it matter? So we're going to die either way. If we enter the city, verse 4, the famine is still in the city and we're going to die there. So if we try to go back in, we're going to die. If we stay out here, we're going to die. We're going to die regardless. Here's our idea, verse 4. Let us go over to the camp of the Arameans. If they spare us, we shall live. And if they kill us, we but die. Like, we're going to die one of three ways. Let's just die this way. So let's go into them. They have food. Let's see what happens. Okay, that's their idea. Crazy idea. These four leprous men say, let's try it. Okay. Verse 5, they arose at twilight, went into the camp of the Arameans. And behold, when they get over there, end of verse 5, nobody is there. Now the Arameans are sitting there waiting to attack Israel, right? That's what Ben-Hadad has been trying to do this whole time, and Elijah's been thwarting it, but he's coming back to now attack them. Verse 6, watch what God has done in the meantime.
For the Lord had made the army of the Syrians hear the sound of chariots and of horses hired against us, the king of Hittites, and the sound of great armies, so that they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us, the king of the Hittites, and the kings of Egypt to come against us.
So the Arameans are sitting there, and what do they hear? They hear chariot. They hear a huge army. So much so that they think Israel must have partnered with the Hittites and Egypt, and they must have a gazillion warriors. We should probably just run now, right? And that's exactly what they do. So they, you know, flee base and they leave everything there, literally. Like they leave the food cooking on the stove and get out of Dodge. And these lepers walk in and think, hello, buffet, like we've got everything, okay? So they gourd themselves, they eat. Verse 8, they entered one into the tent, they ate, they drank, they carried away silver, and they went and hid them. So they take all this stuff, they've got silver, they've got gold, they've got food, they've got everything. And in verse 9, after they have literally like are, you know, fat and satisfied and got their foot up on the lazy boy and enjoying, you know, a good belly scratch after dinner, this is what they say in verse 9.
Then they said to one another, we are not doing right. This day is a day of good news. If we are silent and wait until the morning light, punishment will overtake us.
What does that mean? If what? Why is this, what we are doing is not right? What does that mean? We should share. Like, we need to tell our countrymen about the fact that there is a buffet that four of us can't quite eat by ourselves. There's a ton of food, right? I heard a pastor long ago use this text to talk about evangelism, and it was a great angle on it. Like, we have to take this news to the people. This is great news, and it's not right for us to sit here in our little holy huddle and not go share these things, okay? So sure enough, they do, okay? Verse 10, they called to the gatekeepers of the city, told them the story. No one's there. There's a ton of food. The gatekeepers called to the king and said, man, these guys have some really interesting news that you're going to want to hear. Verse 12, King Joram isn't quite convinced. Read that. So what does he think's actually happening? What does Joram think? It's a trick, right? And he says, listen, go find out. One of the servants said, great, come, take some men with me. Let's go see. So verse 14 or 13, they send some people to go check it out. 14, two chariots with horses the king sent after the army of the Arameans and said, go and see. Okay, verse 16, the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. In verse 16, we see that the famine is indeed over. It is true. Verse 17, the people trampled on him at the... I'm sorry. The king appointed... Sorry, we missed a really important part. 16, the famine's over and all the people come and eat. Okay? Now, what did Elisha tell Joram would happen tomorrow? You're going to see the food and you're going to die. Verse 17. So they just run him over going to get food. So they're hungry, right? So it's it's buffet time and they're not dealing with the king. So he literally dies. And you see it here, two measures of barley for a shekel. So, I mean, you're seeing the famine is now gone. God provided this thing and Joram dies by getting trampled by his own people because of his lack of faith in what God had provided. And sure enough, he is good and dead. Okay? Nope. That's... Yeah, I don't know. That's a half miracle. That one doesn't count. So, no. So says Ryrie. It's not in my chart. Nope. Nope. That's nothing. That's nothing. That's not near as cool as an axe head rising from the water. So, he doesn't do it. God does that one. So, what was Callie's good point? There you go. See, just listen to Callie. So.
I just said Elisha didn't do it.
Speak, Callie, speak. What say, Callie? She is the female prophetess. There you go. So, all right. So there you go. Okay. So yeah, I don't include it in my list of miracles. But if you want to, he can have 15. But he didn't do that one. So good call. Okay. Now, verse 8 and following, we get a little aside, which is kind of it's kind of bizarro. So you remember the Shunammite woman that we had seen God give a son, take a son, bring the son back? In the midst of this, God speaks to her and says, hey, by the way, there's a famine coming for 7 years. Get out of Dodge, okay? Leave town, abandon everything, go live with the Philistines, and you're going to get sustenance there, okay? She comes back into town 7 years later after the famine's over at God's command, and now the king basically had said, Your land's gone, okay? Elisha comes on her behalf and says, hey, can this gal have her land back, right? And in verse 6, this is King Joram's response before he gets trampled by all those people.
In verse 4, Gehazi.
There he is. Thank you. Yep, that's where I knew he was there. See, I knew I read that this morning. There's Gehazi, Callie.
That's crazy that he stayed, even though Elisha gave him leprosy.
And maybe he gets healed for time being, but it's stuck in his family. I don't know the exact ins and outs. It's a non that kind. Yeah, the better, the lesser.
I don't know. If somebody gave me leprosy, I would probably be mad at them.
Probably be mad at them. That's truth, girl. You're speaking truth again. If you gave me leprosy, I would be mad at you. This is true. That's fair. True.
It wasn't just him, it's his entire
family. Right? No bueno. Verse 6. Watch what happens to the Shunammite woman. Yes, same gal.
Verse 6. And when the king asked the woman, she told him. So the king appointed an official for her, saying, restore all that was hers, together with all the produce of the fields from that day that she left the land until now.
So this is almost like Mephibosheth-esque. She leaves town during the famine. She gets her land back, and all the produce that her land would have produced had there not been a famine. So she's provided for 7 years during the famine. She gets back and she gets 7 years of abundance that the land didn't even have to give her in the first place. So just a cool story of a parenthesis that happened in the midst of this famine that they were dealing with, that God takes care of this woman and cares about her. So anyway, she's at a very different place with God now in this story. Okay. Now, verse 7 now, we're going to do a bit of a trade-off. So Elijah had commanded, had been commanded by God, remember, after his deep depression, to go anoint a new guy king in Syria, okay? It was Ben-Hadad. He was the current king on the throne. Verse 8, Hazazel is the new king that Elijah had appointed years and years ago. Okay, now Elisha is going to meet up with him, and this guy's about to become king. This guy's filthy, okay? So 8, verse 7, let's watch what happens.
Now Elisha came to Damascus. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick. And when it was told him, the man of God has come here, the king said to Hazael, take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord through him, saying, shall I recover from this sickness?
Okay, so again, fasting. This pagan king is asking him, hey, Elisha, am I going to get better? And he says, kinda. Verse 9.
So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him, all kinds of goods to Damascus, 40 camel loads.
Now, why would you bring the man of God 40 camel loads worth of something? That's not just a present. That's it's called a bribe. Like, you say what I want you to say, right? So make me better. Will I recover from the sickness? Verse 10, keep going.
And Elisha said to him, go say to him, you shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly.
You're going to get better, but you're still going to die. So it's kind of the news he wants to hear. And Elisha, even with these gifts, is just, he cuts it clean. Yeah, you're going to get better. And yeah, you're going to die. So, and he's going to tell him, here's how it happens. Okay. Dave, keep going to 11.
And he fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was embarrassed.
All the he's get confusing here. Elisha fixed his gaze steadily on him and Hazazel until Hazazel was ashamed. And the man of God wept. And he weeps because he knows what's coming. He's going to get better, but this is how you're going to die, okay? Why does my Lord weep? He says to Hazazel, or whatever his name is. There's too many. It's me. Just, yeah. Hazel. He's pretty eyes. And he says to him, Elisha says, because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. Their strongholds will be set on fire. The young men that you will kill with the sword. Like, I know it's coming from you and from your dynasty. Okay. Verse 13, he says, you know, who is me? I'm yet a dog. Why? Okay. And he says at the end of verse 13, the Lord has shown me that you will be king over Aram. This is the next king. And he's saying, I'm weeping because your current king is going to get better. And then you're going to be the next king. And I know how it's going to happen. And ultimately, when you become king, you're going to be a wrecking ball through Israel. So this isn't good news, okay? Elisha's saying this to the guy that is going to be the next king of... Yeah. Okay? This was the guy that Elijah had said years ago, you're going to be the next king, Okay? And now it's time for him to become the next king, and it's not a good thing for Israel. Okay? That's why Elisha is weeping. He's like, oh boy, this is going to be bad for Israel, but this is God's will. So he's even in control of this pagan country. This is how the current king, Ben-Hadad, this is how he dies. Verse 14 and 15, just read all that.
Then he departed from Elisha and came to his master.
This is Hazael, whatever his name is, goes back to Ben-Hadad and is telling him this news.
Who said to him, what did Elisha say to you? And he answered, he told me that you would certainly recover.
Now, is that what Elisha said? Yeah, it's a half-truth. You're going to get better. However, verse 15.
But the next day, he took the bedcloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face until he died.
So how does the king die? So I shouldn't laugh at that. He gets like waterboarded and he just kills him. He's murdered right there. So yeah, you're going to get better, but you're going to die. And I'm going to be the instrument of your death. So he takes a wet pillowcase and sticks it over his face and literally just kills the guy on the spot.
So, okay, this is really confusing.
It is.
So the Lord used Elisha for this to happen?
Because he just predicted it.
Would Hazael have done this without knowing that he was going to be king?
Yeah, I mean, you get the idea that this isn't God acting. God is not doing this evil. He's just predicting what's going to happen. So, yeah, and Elijah had predicted that years ago. So I don't put the blame on God. This guy's a murderer anyway. And by the way, he's going to treat Israel in the days to come. It's just, it's a bad situation. So, okay. So, all right.
The king was supposed to get better. So is it more like he would have gotten better if Hazael hadn't killed him?
It's one of those great questions. And he does. He recovers from his sickness. So that part's true. Yeah, he doesn't die from sickness. He dies from a wet pillowcase on his face. So, tied really tight, okay? Gets killed. So you're not going to die from, you know, chicken pox. You're going to die from your commander here who's going to kill you, okay? So, all right? Now, a little note on the next king in Israel, by the way, okay? This is why Jehoshaphat is a ding-dong. I keep telling you he's Odie. This is why he's Odie. He's just too stupid for his own good, okay? The next king in the south, okay, is Jehoram. So not to be confused with the Jehoram or the Joram that we've been studying the whole time, okay? And he's not super important, but this is what's going on, okay? Verse 16, this new guy becomes king in Judah, Jehoram. He's 32 years old. His dad is Jehoshaphat. Okay, so just look on your chart. You got Jehoshaphat, and then you've got the next king is Joram. Verse 18, I want you to notice who his kinfolk are. Read that.
He walked in the ways of the king of Israel as the house of Ahab had done, for he married a daughter of Ahab. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord.
Okay, now stop for a second. Ahab's king in the north, right? He reigned during Jehoshaphat's day. Jehoshaphat's son marries a daughter of pagan king Ahab. How did that happen? Think about that for a second. So Jehoshaphat, so once the kingdom is united, Ahab says, hey, how about you take my daughter? And how about your son marries my daughter, okay? Her name is Athaliah. She is hideous, okay? She's probably not as bad as Jezebel, but a half step underneath her, okay?
Jezebel's her mom, right?
Yes. Yep. So she's got bad genes, okay? So do you see how Jehoshaphat's just not thinking clearly? He so wants to unite the kingdoms that he's going to let his son marry some pagan woman, right, whose mom is Jezebel and his dad is Ahab. Like, that can't end good. That gene pool is, you know, that's a swamp, not a pool, right? That's bad. Nothing good comes out of that.
So both Jehoshaphat and Ahab named their sons Jehoram.
Yeah, maybe that's another idiot move on his part. Like, well, he named his kid Joram, maybe I will too. I don't know. I don't know how I got there. But regardless, we got two kings with the same name on the two different thrones in Israel at the same time. No, she's dead. No, sorry, she's about to die. She died this morning when I was studying, but she's not dead yet. So she's dead to me, not dead to you. Jehoram and Joram, do they?
Yeah, on my ESV, anyways, they got Joram as Israel and Jehoram as.
Well, both of their other names are the other name, so it's Joram or Jehoram. You can call either one of them. Either one, it's Like, why? Pick an eight. Like, one of you take one, one of you take the other. Like, we don't care which. So, for what it's worth. All right, let's quickly move through just the rest of this chapter, okay? There's not a whole lot to note on this guy. So this next king, just that his daughter is Athaliah, or his wife is Athaliah. She's going to be, if you look under two more down, you got Joram, then you got Ahaziah, then you got the Athaliah Rebellion. She decides she's going to be queen of Israel.
What?
Yeah, so that's why she gets weird, okay? So she's going to kill a bunch of kids and say, oh, there's no males around. I'll be the king. Queen, right? Jehu is going to be the guy that's going to deal with her and Mama coming up in a little bit. Okay, so that's coming. Okay, 24. Joram, this king that we just read about, goes to sleep with his father, so he dies. It's hilarious. God, actually, turn real quick. Go to 2 Chronicles 21:15. Go to your right. 21:15. Okay, again. The behind-the-scenes director's cut of the kings of Judah. That's Chronicles, okay?
Who did?
Joram, the guy, the new king on the block that we just read about in the south, in Judah, he dies. 21, yeah, he didn't get a long life, or he didn't get a long story. 21:15, watch what God does to this guy. This is how he dies.
And you yourself will have a severe sickness with a disease of your bowels until your bowels come out because of the disease day by day.
Like, whoa, God curses the guy's bowels. So he's evil. The reason he does that is because in the Chronicles version of this story, we don't get it here, he kills all of his brothers. Okay? Why do you kill all your brothers? So I can be the only king. Okay? That's the mentality of the people right now, right? Very pagan king-ish. I'm the king. I have brothers. You're all a threat. You're all dead. And God says, no, 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 no. That's not how we do it here. You're going to have, like, chronic diarrhea or something. I don't know. He got his bowels cursed, and then he dies. Okay? So we'll finish with him. We will pick up in the reign of Ahaziah. And Ahaziah is the next king coming. Okay? Chapter 8. Ahaziah is another guy. He's not from that line. No. Jehu is Joab. He's a military guy that God's going to tap on the shoulder and say, we got a problem. We're going to anoint you the next king, and you're going to deal with all of this chaos that's happening right now. So, yeah, he's an odd guy. Comes from kind of middle of nowhere. And he starts great. He's the one king in Israel. You go, ooh, really? And then you're like, dang it. No. So Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday of next week. So I'm confident that we'll be able to finish. I'm not confident that we'll be able to finish and have breakfast Friday at the pace that we're moving at. So, yeah. Sorry. We'll see. I will try really hard. Ezra and Nehemiah can go quick, though.
I feel like you need to charm all the Syrian kings.
Exactly. Well, look on the side, and you've got there, Ben-Hadad. Can't you see that in the 4-point font, Raven? It's right there. I don't know how that didn't stand out at you. Yeah, they're there. No, it's coming. After the death of Elisha.